Good morning, everyone. Before we begin, Judge Bumate and I would like to welcome and thank Judge Seiler from the Sixth Circuit, who's sitting with us this week.
Welcome and thank you, Judge Seiler.
You're welcome.
The first case on calendar for argument is United States versus Jose Luis Arteaga Centeno. Counsel for appellant, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Evgeny Parkman for the defendant appellant, Jose Arteaga Centeno. I will reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. This appeal is about holding the government to the same rules as other litigants. The government violated the rules in Mr. Arteaga's immigration proceedings and his criminal case. As a result, the immigration court lacked jurisdiction to remove him, and the district court did not have jurisdiction to reconsider a final judgment in his favor. I'll start with the district court's jurisdiction. After Mr. Arteaga initially won below, the government appealed, then moved for an indicative ruling under Rule 37 in the district court, and moved this court for a remand under Rule 12.1. And before this court decided on the remand motion, it dismissed its appeal. The government chose not to litigate remand because it did not want the district court's order releasing Mr. Arteaga during the appeal to go into effect. And it also did not want to appeal or further litigate that release order. So it thought up a shortcut. It just dismissed its appeal and then moved for reconsideration in the district court 45 days after final judgment. That shortcut does not work because neither the government's Rule 37 motion nor its late reconsideration motion vested the district court with jurisdiction to reconsider the final judgment. District court disagreed because the government moved under Rule 37 within 30 days of final judgment. There's no decision from any court that the government has cited, or I'm aware of, that reaches that same holding. And the district court's holding is contrary to Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 12.1 and the Supreme Court's decision reasoning in Ibarra about reconsideration motions.
Counsel, why don't we consider the movement under Rule 37 to be the substantive ruling for motion for reconsideration? Because Rule 37 is not a substantive motion. It's just for an indicative ruling on a substantive motion. So when you ask for Rule 37 indicative ruling, you're substantively moving under another underlying motion, such as the motion reconsider here.
So, Your Honor, Rule 37 and Rule 12.1 are exceptions to the general rule that parties are litigating in a single forum. So here, Rule 12.1 places exclusive authority in this court. It requires a remand from this court before a district court regains jurisdiction as a result of a motion filed under Rule 37. If there's no special exception for Rule 37, for motions filed under Rule 37 within 30 days of final judgment. Otherwise, if this court denied remand under Rule 12.1, then the government could actually override that by dismissing its appeal at any point during the appellate litigation and then go back down to the...
But doesn't what matters is when the timing of the government's motion for reconsideration, if they'd moved it simultaneously with Rule 37, I agree with you that district court didn't have jurisdiction, but we're talking about timing of making a motion. So why wasn't their timing proper?
Because Rule 37 is an exception to the general rule, right? So without Rule 37, they couldn't have... the district court would have had to dismiss the quote-unquote reconsideration motion for lack of jurisdiction. So Rule 37 allowed the district court a limited power to consider it and to indicate what it would do. But that the motion doesn't act as a reconsideration motion because that's not one of the features of Rule 37. So my argument is that Rule 37 and Rule 12.1 are kind of like two sides of a coin. And the only purpose of Rule 37 is to give this court more information under Rule 12.1 to make a decision about whether to remand or not to remand.
Are you saying that Rule 37 motion was not proper at all?
No, the Rule 37 motion was proper, and then the rules require for Rule 37, for motions filed under Rule 37, to then proceed under Rule 12.1. So my argument is that Rule 37 is like limited exception. And so if the government actually wanted to file a reconsideration motion, it needed to dismiss its appeal first and then file under Rule 37. Otherwise, it invites its gamesmanship where parties are proceeding in both forms. And so the possibility in this particular appeal is that even if the appellate court denied remand under Rule 12.1, so the government moved under Rule 37, and it was up to this court under Rule 12.1 whether the case stays here or goes back down. But even if this court denied remand under 12.1, then actually the government could have, at any point during the appellate litigation, it could have dismissed its appeal and then gone back down to the district court, potentially even after briefing. And then whoever would have lost could have started over again and gone back to this court. And then, so that's the kind of gamesmanship that the rules are designed to avoid. That's why Rule 37 and Rule 12.1 are pairs. They work together. And there's no effect of a Rule 37 motion other than under Rule 12.1 to give this court more information about whether to go back or to stay here.
Counsel, in your view, what was the effect of the oral motion to reconsider?
So I think there's no effect, because the only thing that the district court could do with a motion not filed pursuant to Rule 37 is to dismiss it for lack of jurisdiction. So the only thing the government could do is move under Rule 37 for a relief that's prohibited, which is for reconsideration. But then
what case are you relying upon to support your position that the oral motion was of no effect?
So I'm relying on Griggs, which is basically I'm relying on Rule 12.1 and the Supreme Court's decision in Ibarra, because there's no decision that the government has cited or that I know of where a Rule 37 motion has that effect that the government is asking for. So a Rule 37 motion has any kind of effect outside of Rule 12.1.
Well, is there a case that says it cannot have that effect?
I think Rule 12.1 presumes that a remand is required in order for a Rule 37 motion to have any effect. And so without a remand, there cannot be any effect to that motion. And so the Rule 37 motion also couldn't have extended the government's deadline to actually file for reconsideration.
Yes, one question I have, though, Rule 12.1 says if a timely motion is made in the district court for relief. So it seems to suggest that when the motion is made in the district court, makes it timely, or else 12.1 doesn't even take effect. So why wouldn't the oral motion make it a timely motion, then Rule 37 and 12.1 then come into effect?
So I think that would mean that you can only move for reconsideration in the district court within 30 days of final judgment, even in light of Rule 37. And I think so that Rule 37 was intended to only apply to, well, the motions that the committee had in mind were like for a sentence modification or based on new evidence. So the timeliness refers to the event that happened that allows, that makes a motion timely. So I think for reconsideration motions, that refers to the actual decision from this court. For example, under the local rules, a reconsideration motion is timely if it's brought within a certain time of a decision from a higher court or new evidence being found. So here, the motion was timely because it was within a reasonable time of Kerr and Geethy being decided. But I think it would prove too much to say that a motion, if something is on appeal, you have to then bring a reconsider, or you have to bring the motion in the district court in a timely fashion. Otherwise, the district court could reject it when it comes back down from the Court of Appeals. And if I may reserve the remainder of my time, please.
Yes, you may. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Nikhil Bhagat on behalf of the United States. The government timely moved for reconsideration of the district court's ruling on Arteaga's first motion to dismiss, and it properly exercised its inherent authority to reconsider that order. Moreover, the mere fact that the NTA that was first served on Mr. Arteaga didn't bear the immigration court's address did not deprive the immigration court of subject matter jurisdiction over his entire case. And that's for two reasons. First, the regulations themselves are not jurisdictional. And second, even if they are, the INS in this case complied with them. Given the court's discussion with my colleague, I think I'll start with the issue of the district court's reconsideration. The district court here dismissed the indictment on January 8th, and the government first sought reconsideration on February 1st, which is well within that 30-day timeframe that has been established by this court's cases in Jones and other cases. There's nothing to restrict the government from seeking reconsideration while in the district court while the appeal was pending. This court said that in Jones, or at least it was that in Jones and in Coleman. And I think, Judge Bumate, you hit the nail on the head. My friend keeps saying this Rule 37 motion. There's no such thing as a Rule 37 motion. Rule 37 only dictates what the district court can do when it receives a substantive motion. In this case, the substantive motion was the motion for reconsideration. And I think in their papers, they talk about, well, there was a Rule 37 motion on February 1st, but the substantive motion didn't really come till February 22nd. I think the court has the record of the February 1st hearing transcript. I think it's clear that everyone was under the understanding that the government was moving for reconsideration. The district court comes out of the gate and says, well, let me guess, you're going to move for reconsideration, right? And then the government sort of responds to that. So I think with respect to the reconsideration motion, it's clearly timely. And again, if you look at the application notes to Rule 37, the advisory committee notes, they actually contemplate the filing of a timely motion while jurisdiction is with the Court of Appeals. I think I'd like to move on.
May I ask you a question regarding your citation to Jones? Are you talking about United States versus Jones 608 S. 2nd 386?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So tell me the precise language in that case that allows the district court to reconsider its ruling while the appeal is pending. While the appeal is pending in the appellate court.
So, Your Honor, the what Jones said, and that
is give me a pin site and some language.
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have the pin site right in front of me, but my understanding of Jones is that it said that the government's notice of appeal did not preclude the district court from acting within its own power in inviting and entertaining the request for reconsideration. And in that case, the district court actually invited the government to bring a second motion for reconsideration while the notice of appeal was pending. So I think from Jones, we understand that the mere filing of the notice of appeal does not preclude the district court from acting to reconsider its own motion.
That's why I wanted you to give me the precise language, because Jones seems to say it's a reconsideration is appropriate during the time that an appeal can be taken, not when the appeal has actually been filed.
Well, Your Honor, it did also say that, and I think the government's motion for reconsideration here was on February 1st, and that is well within that 30-day limit, the time that the appeal could be taken under Section 3731.
Well, there's a distinction between the time when the appeal may be taken and the time when it's actually filed, because when it's filed, it divests the district court of jurisdiction, generally.
That's correct, Your Honor. It divests the district court of jurisdiction to act, right? But it doesn't, just because the notice of appeal has been filed and the district court doesn't have jurisdiction, that doesn't preclude a party from filing the motion to reconsider, because that's exactly what Rule 37 was designed for. Rule 37 is designed for the district court to take some sort of action while the while it doesn't have jurisdiction, on a motion that it gets while it doesn't have jurisdiction, it can either defer it, either deny it, or it can do what it did in this case, which is file the, which is do the indicative ruling.
If we discount the or motion for reconsideration, was the motion for reconsideration timely?
Your Honor, I think it's a more difficult case for us. I think our argument in that case would be if the court were to consider that the motion for reconsideration was filed not on February 1st, but on February 22nd when the papers, the briefs were filed, I think that's a more difficult case for us. I think our argument would be that the 30 days, the 30-day clock is only running while the district court has jurisdiction. But certainly, I think in this case, our primary argument is it was filed within the 30 days. It was filed on February 1st. It was an oral motion. The district court certainly had inherent authority to accept the oral motion. And if you look at even the minutes, that's at court record 47. It's clear that everyone was under the understanding that the motion for reconsideration was filed.
Well, the court recognized that it had been made, did it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The district court recognized that oral motion was a motion, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court recognized that, and it also recognized that in its order. This jurisdictional argument was brought below in Mr. Arteaga's second motion to dismiss, and the district court expressly recognized that it had considered it as an oral motion made on February 1st. Because again, there's no such thing as a Rule 37 motion. The only motion that possibly could have been made was this motion for reconsideration. Your Honors, with the court's permission, I'd like to move on briefly to the immigration court issue.
Counsel, the one question I had is the what the government pretends to cure the defect, which is ER 147. What is that document? It doesn't say that it's a NTA. It says it's a notice of custody redetermination. So how would that cure any defect in the NTA?
So, Your Honor, that goes to the regulation. So if you look at the cases, they talk about 8 CFR 1003.18. And 1003.18 says, look, if the NTA itself didn't have the address on it because it wasn't practicable, it's up to the immigration court then to provide notice of the time and place of the hearing later. And that's what this document does. I think the regulation 0.18 doesn't specify that it has to be a particular type of document or have a particular title on it. All it says is the immigration court has to give notice later. And I think our position is that even though this is titled a notice of custody redetermination hearing, it's still providing notice. And there's no dispute in the record as to the fact that this document was served. I think, counsel raises something about whether it was actually received or not, but it was certainly served.
Was this issue presented to the district court? Because that seems like it would take some fact-finding.
The district court did not consider this issue of the subsequent piece of paper. No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think our arguments with respect to the immigration issue, I think largely this issue is governed by Aguilar-Ferman. I think in Aguilar-Ferman, this court deferred to the BIA and Rosales-Vargas on both of these two regulations, 1003.14 and 1003.15 sub B sub 6. I think that is really that's sort of the narrowest way to decide this.
In those cases, the subsequent documents were in the same nature of the notice to appear. Here, there's something different than the usual immigration documents. What do you make of that?
So you're absolutely right, Your Honor. I think what I would point the court to is the language in Aguilar-Ferman. They're both on page 894, 895, and particularly I'd point the court to footnote 4 of Judge Bybee's opinion. I think that part of Aguilar-Ferman really makes it clear that this court is giving deference to the BIA's findings in Rosales Vargas, which found that both of these regulations that are at issue here are not jurisdictional. They don't go to subject matter jurisdiction, and they simply are not a basis to come in later, like Mr. Arteaga is doing, and claim that his entire proceeding was null and void. Your Honors,
would you object to a remand on this issue for the district court to sort it all out?
I'm sorry, what issue, Your Honor?
On the issue of jurisdiction and whether or not there was adequate notice to the
applicant. Your Honor, I don't think this court needs to do that. I think the regulations.
My question was, would you object to it?
Your Honor, I think if the court believes that that is germane to the issue here to decide it, then I think we would be fine with that. But I don't actually think the court needs to go there.
I think we can decide if we need to do it or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you had an objection.
I apologize, Your Honor. Yes.
Any other questions? All right, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just three quick points. One, the government could not have moved for reconsideration in the district court because it needs leave to move for reconsideration. So its motion could not have been a motion for reconsideration.
Well, if the court accepted it, isn't that implicit leave?
I guess if the court, the usual procedure is you move for leave first and then you move for reconsideration. I don't think the court could grant leave while the case is up for appeal, and it doesn't know what the Court of Appeals is going to do with that, whether it's going to keep this as an appeal or send it back down. Second, I think that the rules presume that Rule 37 is going to function in conjunction with Rule 12.1. And I think there's a danger to separating these. And one possible gamesmanship that I would identify in this situation is if truly all the government needed to do was move under Rule 37, then it really could wait until briefing was done, a panel was appointed, and then just dismiss the appeal. And then its initial motion under Rule 37 would have been all it needed to do. And then
I think no one disagrees with that the government could have done that. The issue is whether the government was required to do that.
Well, so what I'm trying to say is that the rules shouldn't allow a kind of situation where the government could move under Rule 37 and just sit on it for as long as it wants, because then this court's Rule 12.1 authority doesn't matter. Even if this court denied remand under 12.1, the government could sit on it all the way down the line and then just dismiss its appeal because it had reserved its prophylactic Rule 37 motion way earlier on in the case. And my argument is that the rules they're designed not to work in that way. They're designed to put the authority in this court to decide under Rule 12.1. If the government dismissed the appeal, sure, then it can move for reconsideration within the time. It's their prerogative. But once they move under Rule 37, they were bound by the Rule 12.1.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You've exceeded your time. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The next